better way to do this. Let me show you a better way.
Well, hi, folks. This is Jack Spierko with another edition of the Survival Podcast. As always, one man's view of the changing world, the changing times, and the things we can all do to live a better life. Times get tough, or even if they don't. Today is Thursday, September the 19th, 2024, and we are up to episode 3,561 of the Survival Podcast. Every once in a while, things just kind of hit you. For some of you guys that really have been around since, like, the Jetta days, and if you don't know what they are, ask somebody in the community, they'll tell you. But that means you were around in like 08, 09 timeline. And I have a question for those of you who have been so damn good to me that you've been with me that long. Back in those days, did you ever think I would get on the air and say, we're up to episode 3,500 and anything? Because I'm not sure that I did. I really believed in this right from the beginning, or there's no way I could have built it. It was different at the time. There were some definite advantages to being early into the podcast game, but, you know, you're talking about a time where you're trying to build a show that can provide an income for you, and when somebody asked you, well, what do you do, and you said, I'm a podcaster, the next question out of their mouth was, generally, probably 80 to 90% of the time, what's a podcast? So thank you to all of you who have helped me build this show over the years, including those of you that don't go back that far. But, again, just thank you. Thank you very much. I also want to say something about the show I did yesterday and an email I got today and I responded to, and I think I corrected it, but I just want to make sure that I don't hurt anybody's feelings. So a guy wrote me an email yesterday about learning about Bitcoin, and he went through this whole, like, biography about his life and what he wanted to do and how he needed somebody to help him learn more about Bitcoin. And I emailed back, look, here's my fundamentals series. I don't really do this kind of one-on-one consulting. I thought I was very clear about that over the years. I'm not really sure why you would think. And then I kept going through my email, and then I found another email that was very similar, except it was more specific, and it said, I would love to come on the air and have you walk me through Bitcoin and ask you questions about it. And I realized, oh, dummy. You said, hey, I could use somebody that knows even less than Ken to do this with. And so I emailed that person back and said, I'm sorry if I got this wrong. And yeah, and then there was two more. So I've had four people email me about being kind of the Bitcoin newbie on an episode of Bitcoin Breakout. And I assume that first person was. It wasn't clear, but I assume it was. And I just want to say I'm sorry if I came off like a dick. Because like I asked, you did, and then I'm like, I don't do this. And I just want to say something about emails you might get from me or responses you might get from me on occasion. Until you're answering, say, 200 to 300 legitimate emails every morning, it will be hard for you to really understand how sometimes you can mix things up and cross a wire. And so if you ever get a response to me and you're like, that was kind of a dickish response, and I don't feel like I was being an asshole, email me back and say, look, man, did you understand what I was saying? And I might tell you, yeah, go screw. Or I'll probably say, I guess I didn't. I'm sorry. And so I'll preemptively and retroactively at the same time apologize. If I've ever done that to you, just understand, like, and it's not me. It's anybody that does what I do. When you email a person, you're probably emailing a person who is told they're a fucking retard about 19 times a day in various ways. And puts things out that are constantly attacked as being conspiracy theories or whatever. And it doesn't matter, okay, that I'm in kind of this independent position, anarcho-libertarian position. If I was right-wing, it would be the same. If I was left-wing, it would be everybody that does this. If you're making a real difference, you have haters. And sometimes the person that you didn't mean to do it to gets caught up in that conflict, collateral damage type of thing. And so if I've ever seemed like a dick, and you were not being a dick to me, I probably misinterpreted it, or there's even the occasion where you hit reply and you move the thing down one and you're actually replying to the wrong email. That's happened a time or two, so I'm sorry if that's ever happened to you. Now, what are we going to talk about today? Well, Trump says we're losing our country. Is he right? That'll be covered by Chris Rossini and Dr. Ron Paul and the Ron Paul Liberty Highlights. And I'll have to mention at this point that they believe there might have been a third assassination attempt, if not just a attempt to do harm to Trump from a rally he did yesterday, were several people that were very close to him, kind of people you see in the back behind the audience, all ended up at a hospital in Arizona with serious chemical wounds. This shit's getting crazy. And the reason I say that is I'm going to bookend this with my segment today. It'll make sense when I get there. Annie McCann will be talk about convincing your fat prepper friend that he needs to not be fat if he wants to be prepped. Ken Berry will talk about something I've heard a lot about. I've never put much validity in. So I'm very interested to hear what Ken will say. B-17 and cancer. Is there a link? Is B-17 actually something that cures cancer? Is B-17 deficiency the cause of any or some cancers? And I actually don't think so. I think this is one of those overhyped bullshit things, right? With no real evidence. But we'll see what Ken says, because I know Ken digs into shit like this. Sean Mills will talk about getting a toilet to flush when you don't have a septic tank. I know you're like, what do you mean you don't have a septic tank? Well, it's not that uncommon. I grew up, well, partially grew up in a house in rural Pennsylvania. We didn't have a septic tank. We also didn't have this problem. And when Sean gives his answer, I'll explain with that why we didn't have that problem. But it was still not a good thing. Carrie Brown will talk about the American persimmon, one of the greatest plants for foraging, for planting, for wildlife and livestock management for ranchers as well. This is a fantastic underutilized species. Joel Riles will talk about something that's always hard as a dog owner, and I would say as a cat owner too, but dogs, I don't know, just seem to move into a place in your heart that even as much as I loved all our cats, a dog is just different. There comes a time for most dog owners where you have to come to the determination, is it time to say goodbye? Do I need to put my friend down? And that's, you know, we put the dog down. It's not that way when you are a real dog lover and a dog owner. It is putting your friend down. And it's not easy. And the longer you live and the longer you make dogs part of your life, the more times you'll have to deal with it. And it's always hard. It doesn't get any easier. I have a very quick guest appearance by Jeff Gleason, Jeff the Berkey guy. And we're going to talk about what's going on with the EPA and Berkey. And there's not a really great answer to this or a resolution yet. It's still kind of in limbo, but I thought it was important since Jeff is a sponsor, and I tell you to go buy from him, and a lot of times when you go to buy Black Berkey filter elements, they don't have any, but a lot of other times they do. And I would tell you that, you know, Jeff has an email list there. You might, if you want to buy product from him, you might want to get on the email list, because I'm pretty sure when they get product in, they let their database know about it. But Berkey's really been done wrong here, and it actually will dovetail. I put it at the end of the experts today because it will dovetail nice into my segment, which is not really related to Berkey directly at all. But the way I put it is, are people at the edge of a true awakening as to the absolute malicious evil that our government has been doing for a very long time? This is not new. The awareness level of it, I think, is new. It is very new. And I think the problem has become worse over time, because all problems are cancers, and all cancers, when ignored and when no correction is given, metastasize and spread. And so, I'm sorry, the question then becomes, if we have an awakening and we have a system that is malicious, that the people that enjoy it and know what it is and benefit from it are terrified of losing because they've built everything they have on it with multiple contingencies. If we get to this awakening that everybody seems so excited about, and it sounds like such a good thing that the people would wake up, and people like me have been shouting for people to wake up. I've been doing it for 16 years. Wake up, America. Wake up, Western man. This is what's really going on. You live in a fascist economy. You think it's free. It's not. That when you have, you know, a velvet glove over the hand of tyranny, you just feel a little bit better when your balls are being crushed. So you would think, like, woohoo, we're waking people up. And I woke up this morning and I started looking at what was going on X, which, no matter what you think about Elon Musk, and I'm neutral, I don't hate him or love him, I'm like, he is what he is. No matter what you think of X's so-called free speech, it's bullshit. It's not free speech, but it's freer speech than it was a couple years ago. So you get a really good snapshot of the mindset of humanity when you look at X. It's a big network with a big network effect, And so the what you see in the way people think and where they feel and where they are is actually representative. I don't say that social media is real life, but it is a reflection of real life that you then must interpret, because the mirror bends things and makes them look in reverse. So you have to do some work. But there, you can get a good gauge on where people are. And I realized that this morning, that as I've been watching this over this whole summer, we're hitting kind of a crescendo in the symphony of awakening. And I'll talk about a few reasons I feel that way. But my question then is, when we actually get enough people to wake up, when enough people say, hell the fuck no to what's going on, will that actually accelerate the unraveling and lead to conflict? And what might that look like? Because I do think we have a potential for civil war. And I think the vibe is enough. And you have to understand something about my wife. My wife does not hang on my every word. My wife does not listen to my podcast every day. And sometimes when I'm talking about the things that I'm going to talk about or did talk about on the show with my wife, she says, you talk enough. So my wife is not controlled by my words. My wife is not all in on my beliefs. And my wife keeps telling me, maybe we should move further out. And for someone like her to say that tells me that that level of awakening and unraveling is going on throughout this country in ways that I don't believe that it ever really has before. Now, we've had some pretty big unravelings, right? We had the American Civil War. Okay, we had the unraveling of the 60s and the 70s. The reason it's never happened this way before is we've never had the level of technology manipulation and control to unravel. The cycle is the same, the fourth turning. The cycle is the same. But let's look at it this way. You take a rubber band, and somebody holds it really tightly, and you put a pencil in it, and you spin it up, and you spin it like 20 times. And then somebody holds their hand where that pencil can hit them, but just pass through when it hits, so it's just whap, 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 whap. How much does it hurt? Okay. Now you get 10 rubber bands, put the same pencil in there, and wind it up 100 times and let it unravel. Which one does more damage? And all I'm saying is we have a lot more rubber bands and a lot more winding and a lot more potential energy that could go kinetic. That's what I'll be talking about today. With that, let's go ahead and hear from Dr. Paul and Chris Rossini at the Ron Paul Liberty Highlights. Trump says we're losing our country, regardless of what you think of him, as a person, as a man, as a candidate, whatever. Is he right? And I think we need to start analyzing more things this way, because there's plenty of people say things that I disagree with so much they say. Doesn't mean the particular thing they're saying at any given time is wrong.
And you know, the most famous of all collapses of civilization was the one with in the Roman Empire. And I got one quote off the internet just to describe this, what was going on in Rome at the time the collapse came. The fall of the Roman Empire was significantly impacted by a cycle of, guess what, debt and inflation, primarily caused by Roman emperors devaluing their currency by adding cheaper metals like copper to fund military expenditures and other government costs, leading to a drastic increase in the value, a drastic decrease in the value of money and a crippling inflation that ultimately crippled the economy and continued the empire's decline. When Rome got weaker, the outsiders who had been mistreated by the Roman Empire decided they would start invading Rome, and that was then there were the barbarians. Of course, they found out that Rome had already been weakened to a great deal, and the doors were open.
This invasion, a lot of people, they like to just write it off. Oh, that's just for votes. You know, and that's it. And that's the extent of it. No, they could fix votes millions of different ways without changing the makeup of our nation. And in this area, I am in agreement with President Trump. He says our country is being lost. He is right about that. This is not about votes only. I'm sure it's an aspect. But we are meant to, as human beings, to live in community. In fact, we're all born into a community. Every one of us is born into a family. That's a community we don't have a choice in. We're born into it. But after that, there's choices involved. Families with similar values form tribes and towns and states and nations, but there's similarity in beliefs, in language, in, okay, we believe this way, we're going to live peacefully with one another. Once you start messing with similarity in community, now you're going to create big problems. And it's not, you know, rocket science to figure out. If you took my neighbor right there, I'm looking at his house, and you took that family and implanted them into my house with my family, it's not going to be long until we're all at each other's throats. They have all different habits. They maybe stay up late. Their kid wants to be a rock star. Now I have a drummer in my house. So before too long, there's going to be conflict, and we're going to be like, you know what? We have to separate. We don't have enough similarities to live together like this. And it doesn't have to be strangers like my neighbor. I love my in-laws. I love my parents, but I don't want to live with them because, you know, we're going to have conflict. Okay? So what they're doing with our nation is just importing people. We're not talking about, well, they're a land of immigrants. Yeah, my grandparents came here. They had to have a sponsor. They had to have a job. Who is going to be responsible for them? There's no welfare state for you. And they became an American. You know, they left. They were no longer Polish or Italian. They were now Americans. What we're doing today is nothing like that. It's just come walk in. We're going to put you up in hotels and give you down payments for a house. And you know, we see all the other ramifications. So you can't forcefully combine people to live in a community.
Very good. And you put the word forced to do something. And that's such a crucial word. Some people talk about non-aggression, but force is part of it all. And the force is being used, but, you know, force in defense, that's quite a bit different than using force to manipulate people, manipulate their lives, manipulate the economy, manipulate the world, and get all this involved, because that violates all sense of fairness and all sense of what liberty is all about.
Understandably, many people are wondering, what on earth is going on? Why would we do this to ourselves? By we, I mean, why would the government open the borders? This is the exact opposite of what they should be doing. And, you know, for most people, they don't really understand. You, when you deal with regular people like yourself, you don't understand some of the sick people that are out there, the ones that hold power, that think that they're meant to rule the world. They don't see individual people like we do. You know, when I go to the store, I see another individual, and we deal with them. Like, they see people as human clay, as cattle, you know, in another way to put it. And their great enemy is any type of unity. So if there's unity, that's their enemy. So when you import all these people, you're destroying unity, and you're just creating a mishmash of humanity. But to them, they want to then use an iron fist, the totalitarian state, to then mold this human clay into what they want. They'll mold the human clay into LGBT, and everyone is going to listen to our experts. If you need a religion, we'll give you climate change. That's going to be your religion. And that's what they're doing here. And the same exact thing is happening in Europe. There's no more France and Germany. You're European now. Well, what is that supposed to mean, European? Well, we're going to tell you from the top. This is what it means. It's not you're French or German anymore. We're going to mold you, you human clay, into what we want for everyone. And notice who the enemies are of this agenda. In Europe, it's places like Poland, places like Hungary, where they're like, yo, we're not doing this. You know, we'll be in the European Union, but you're not going to mold us into some mishmash, you know, of humanity. And then look at the real big enemies of this: China, Iran, Russia. They're on the global scale saying, you're not going to do this to us, and these are the enemies. And that's why Trump, who wants to put a stop to this, who wants to stop this invasion, is the enemy. That's what people that want this chaos that Dr. Paul just alluded to, this is what they want it for.
I think one of the most important statements in there was something Chris said. And I think it's something that very few people can really get their head around. They don't see you as people. They don't see you as individuals. They see you as clay. And this is very hard for people to get their head around, that other people can think this way. But I want you to imagine being raised in one of these elite families, or being a new member of the elite and then taken into these families. And then to truly get 100% indoctrinated with the concept that all of these stupid drone people would see things our way if they only understood, but they're incapable of understanding, so we must move them like chess pieces to where they need to go for their own best interest. If you think this is new, this has been how every elite class has ever viewed society as a whole for as long as we've had things that you would call a society. As soon as we got past villages, as soon as we got past the concept of like small villages where everybody knew everybody, as soon as we got into like large towns where there was a government that you couldn't just go talk to, that didn't live next door to you, right? That had a walled garden. From the time we got there, the logical outcome of that arrangement is such that there can be no other outcome. Power is the most addictive drug on the planet, and when people take a drug long enough, their mind is altered to the point where the reality they see is different from the reality that is. And then if it's a good drug, and when I say good, I mean a drug that makes you feel good and doesn't kill you, you don't end up in the street with a needle in your arm, right? And you won't from power. You know what happens then? You like it. And what will you do to protect what you like? Everything. And if a bunch of people get killed, as long as it's not you and your friends and your family, oh, well, that's just for the greater good. Think about that, because like I said, I'm going to bookend this with the state of society today when we get to mine at the end. Next up, though, we've seen them. I used to be one. The fat preppers, all right? And let's be, I mean, I was heavy, but no, let's be honest. There's some that, like, bro, how many chins do you need, right? There are people that, like, they can't even walk, they waddle, but they're preppers. And they're going to be prepared for the end of all being. Well, you know, maybe they have something going on with some food storage on body for a while if the food supply dries up. But you're not going to be able to function in a breakdown if that's you. And it's not good. So how do you talk to a person that fancies themselves a prepper? They got the guns, they got the beans, the bullets, and the band-aids, and they're ready to take on the blue helmets, but they are morbidly obese. How do you have that conversation? I'm not sure there's an easy way, but let's hear what Andy McCann has to say about it.
Hey, this is Andy McCann coming to you from Woodstock, Georgia, here at CrossFit Garage. Sanjoy from Georgia. Hey, local guy. Hey, Sanjoy. He asks, I've got a lot of prepping friends to varying degrees, and one odd commonality is how poor their health is. Yes, I think actually Jack just talked about this. So it's health and fitness. It's just another prep to stack, right? Can it also be that one is none and two is one? So I think what he's saying there is, you know, your health and fitness is doubling up there. Yes, be healthy and fit, but it also could help you in that weird time, right? Anyway, how can I get them to stack the prep of health and fitness? Okay, so there's, I guess, two different questions in here, and I like this. Jack, this is probably more up your alley since you're around more of the prepping community than I am, but I have noticed that too. Typically, when we do a thing and we go out and see people, it's they have prepped maybe the easier thing, which is, hey, I used my money to buy something. And you're like, great, but what about your health and fitness? And they're like, well, I did a first step. So I think there's a thing where people don't want to tackle all the projects, and maybe they just want to scratch some things off, and maybe you let some of the harder ones kind of go to the wayside. Like, yeah, one day I'll put in that well. It just takes a lot more time. So the question of, is health and fitness a thing where it's one is none and two is one? So I think yes. So do you want to just get out and do fitness? No, probably not. I mean, I do, but I don't know. In this community, I think you can kind of like help them see the idea that it's going to be good for you, even if times are bad or even if they're not, right? So Jack's slogan right there. So what should they do? I mean, really, anything is better than nothing. And if they were healthy and fit and then something happened, yeah, they would be able to then, you know, live a good life and do things, carry stuff or whatever. So I think a way that I might approach these guys is to ask them questions about what they already enjoy doing inside of their prep. So, I don't know, let's go with, hey guys, let's pretend there's an EMP that does blow up and stuff is knocked out and you want to get out of Dodge, or there's a hurricane or whatever, some sort of scenario where you're like, hey, it's time to bug out. Yeah, what do you have in your bug out bag? And they start listing the things in their bug out bag. And just roll with me here. I'm making this stuff up. But let's just say he's like, I got a 30-06. I got a 9mm. I have several cases of ammo for both of those. Then I've got, and he starts listing all these things out. And you're like, hey, that's awesome. Let's look at what the average backpacker's pack weighs for someone that's doing the Appalachian Trail. So you go and look that up. It's probably going to be between 30 and 50 pounds, somewhere in that range. I really don't know, but I imagine it's in that range. So somebody simply out on the trail trying to live for a couple days between towns is carrying around a 30-pound pack. Actually, let me pause and go look. All right, so I threw in the search there. It says, what's the average weight of an Appalachian Trail backpack? And it says about 25 to 30 pounds. So that was pretty close. So somewhere, let's call it 25 pounds. So already they're hiking a pack that has 25 pounds worth of gear in it. Then they're throwing in a rifle, a gun, and some ammo, and some MREs, and I don't know, whatever else. So you're probably looking at a backpack that's like 50 pounds. Okay, so then you say, hey, Timmy, you said you got this in your backpack. What do you think that weighs? They're like, yeah, it's probably weighing about 50 pounds or something like that. I'm like, okay, well, when's the last time you put 50 pounds on your pack, on your back, and walked it around? They're like, well, maybe never. Like, what do you think would give out first, like in your preps on this escape, this bug out? And they're like, well, I don't know, the backpack straps. Like, so you think the backpack straps would give out before your shoes? What's connected to your shoes? Oh, how about your feet? Do you think your feet are going to be able to take all that, like, pounding? And are you in the mountains or are you on a road? And so basically you can get them thinking about this and help them understand and maybe see that the thing that's lacking in their prep for a bug out scenario where they got to walk is actually probably them. I think another way you can do this is show them what you're doing. So as an example, I'll post some videos or whatever of me doing a thing at our gym and put it on, I guess, Instagram and Facebook are all linked. And so you put it on one and it goes to the other. And my peers who are all about 50 get to see that and say, hey, wow, there's a 50-year-old dude that can do some things that, you know, most 50-year-old guys can't do. And so maybe through action, I can motivate them, say, hey, look at me, even I can do this. It just takes one step at a time. I think the thing that doesn't work is, especially with the proximity bias in play, is when you just simply tell them, hey, you're fat and sluggish and not very fit, you should do something. I don't know if that really works, especially if they're family. Nobody really likes to listen to family. I guess you could aim them at one of my podcasts. Just go into it's called CrossFit Garage. Actually, I think I just changed the name recently so I could start finding a better name and go look what I changed it to. Oh, so I made it even more unique. It's CF for CrossFit. So CF Garage with Andy McCann. Yeah, how unique is that? I'll come up with something better one day. But you can go there and look through those podcasts. I do actually have a couple on diet and nutrition and, you know, eating better. And, of course, you guys know my mindset. I'm slanted towards preps as well. I like the idea of being prepared. I just think this is a good way to do it. So, yeah, I don't think I would, like, hammer into somebody. I don't think that's ever going to go well. And I'd especially lean away from telling family what to do. Instead, I would probably lean on stories and anecdotes and maybe taking them down the trail, pun intended, of, hey, what does it look like when you bug out with your preps, and see if they can sort of make that connection. So I know Jack has a hard line, and I love it. I don't know. I have a hard time taking a hard line when he's like, hey, you guys are fat and you need to fix it. I love it, but I don't know. I'm just not there yet. I'd like to walk people through this. Anyway. If you need specific help with anybody, let me know. I'm happy to help you address that. You can find me, andy@crossfitgarage.com, or you can get to any of our podcasts. I already gave you that name. It's CF Garage with Andy McCann, and we talk about food, fitness, and finance. Of course, you can go on YouTube @andymccann42. Guys, stay healthy, stay strong, and remember, you're going to have to carry that backpack. Jack, what do you think?
I don't have an easy answer for this. I have some really close friends, and when I say close, I mean not geographically, but close because of what I do, that I've worked with for a long time. Some that are extremely overweight, and I've offered, and the way I've offered is like this. Look, man, we both know that you would be better off if you didn't weigh so much, and if you ever want my help, let me know. And then I let it go. And that's all I can do. And I'm going to tell you how many people that I've done that with have come back to me and said, yeah, I'm ready. The answer is zero. So the reason I tell you that isn't to, like, shame any of these people. It is to make you understand that, like, I think there's people who think, well, if Jack said it, then, well, no. No, I don't carry any more weight than you do with your friends, with mine. I don't. And I think it's a personal choice that people have to make. And I think there has to be a point where a person truly realizes that no matter how much they try to deceive themselves, that they're happy with the way things are, that they're not. There isn't an obese person. There isn't one. If you said, I'll tell you, well, maybe there's some that are making money on it or something through some kind of gimmick or some shit or an actor or whatever. Look, let's put those people in a box. Not in an evil box, just out of the way box. There is not an obese person on this planet who's living a normal life otherwise, who if you put a button in front of them and said, if you push that button, you will be 15% body fat when you wake up tomorrow morning, that would give you the button back and not push it. If they believed it would work. Like, you don't have to do anything. You don't have to change anything. You don't have to sacrifice anything. And you won't get sick and die. You will just transform back to kind of a weight that is appropriate for your age and height. All you have to do is push this button. They would all push the button. What does that tell you? That all of them would do it. Because if you have this conversation with people, they'll sell things like, my doctor says I'm fine. My test results are good. My blood pressure's not high. Some bullshit. Like, I don't care. The human frame was not meant to carry the weight that the majority of Americans carry, and the majority of people in the West carry today. And you can say whatever you want about, well, the seed oils, the food spice. Okay, fine. But you choose. You choose what you eat. I'm going to go back to this. If you want the easy button, carnivore or at least ketovore is the path. Now, I'm not saying it's easy to make the change, but easy to get the results. But I know many people, no matter how much you tune into me, no matter how much you look at my transformation, you're just not going to do that. Okay, fine. Here's the recipe to get yourself 10x better than you are. And if you start having improvements with this, maybe you'll do a little bit more if you decide you want a little bit more, because it'll feel good when it starts to change. Less than 100 total carbohydrates a day. That is not the penalty in life that you think it is. That leaves room for a meal with some potatoes in it here and there, okay? Number one. So that's number one. Under one, that is, I will not go any higher than that with you actually wanting to correct your problem. Human beings are not designed to eat, you know, 300, 400, 500 carbs a day. And I've had some people in my family take this path. Not because I offered, but because they found it out on their own. So the prophet having no honor in his own country, but then they come to you. And one in particular who, if you looked at what she ate, you would have never thought, well, this is a person gorging on ho-hos and ding-dongs, right? 375 to 450 carbohydrates a day. It was all quick, expedient junk food. And when she got the keto app, keto.app is where you can get it if you want to use it, and she tracked it, she went, holy shit, what am I doing? 100 carbs is, again, if you do 3 meals a day, and I'd recommend 2, but if you do 3 meals a day, that's 33 carbs a meal, guys. A Coke is like 32. Okay, but you're not going to have Coke. Okay, next in that process, only whole foods that you process yourself. I'm not against anything that, you know, like a purist on this. Like, is bacon processed? Well, yeah. But you know what I mean when I say processed. You know, is sausage processed? We'll read the ingredients. If it doesn't say certain things I'm about to say, you can have it. It's ground meat stuffed in a case with seasonings. I don't care if you do it or somebody does it for you. Okay? So, no processed foods. I'd start with whole foods and cook your own shit. 100 carbohydrates a day. Next up, no, zero, 100% no. You can't have anything that says high fructose corn syrup is no. You can't have it. This will fix the junk food problem cold, because it's almost impossible to find anything in the center of a grocery store in a box or an envelope that doesn't have it. So no high fructose corn syrup at all. No seed oils. No, nothing that says vegetable oil, because there isn't any. There's no such thing as vegetable oil. Mustard seed is not a vegetable. That's what canola oil is. corn oil is not a vegetable. Okay, it is a seed oil, it is a grain oil. No seed oils. Very sparingly use of things like a walnut oil and a hazelnut oil, something like that. You're using it as like a flavoring at the end, not cooking with it. That's fine. Okay, no seed oils. The only oils you should use other than fats derived from animal sources would be olive oil, avocado oil, and coconut oil, and I would steer to the animal side of things. Do not even pay attention to your caloric intake unless you decide you want to accelerate what you're doing. Do those things. Your life will dramatically, dramatically change. And then I would add to it, no grains. No grains and sparing use of legumes. So, you want bread? Make almond bread. Right? And I would say, if you're like, I'm not giving up real bread, make your own fucking bread then. Flour, salt, yeast, and water. And when you say, but is that too extreme? What I want you to do, I want you to go to the fucking store. I want you to pick up any random bag of bread off the shelf and read the ingredients. And then you tell me. Because what you're going to find is it all has either a seed oil in it or high fructose corn syrup. So if you want to eat grains, then you need to you get raw grain and make your own shit. Or like organic flour and make your own bread. There's a book on making your own bread in the T-Spaz catalog. Even though I don't recommend you eat bread. I will add a link to the show notes today for it. And it's really a simple method. You can make bread with, it's something like 30 minutes a week or something like that. And you do your prep on Sunday and then you bake bread every time you need it. And you kind of end up with a little bit of a sourdough component going on with your bread as it ages in the refrigerator. It's really simple to do. Do that. And then you can have your bread, but no more than 100 carbs total in a day. Not net carbs, total carbs. Do that. And anybody out there. Right? That is overweight and is not happy with their life. Volunteer to do that. Do it for 120 days and report back to us on what happened. Without anything extreme. No seed oils. No more than 100 carbs a day. All whole foods. No high fructose corn syrup. And kind of minimize the grains and legumes. See what happens. You'll be shocked what it will do for your life. And it won't feel like a big sacrifice once you get into it. Next up, let's hear about, you know, health. Hey, is cancer a cyanide deficiency? Is that what it is? Cyanide the poison? Yeah, that's what B17 is. It's cyanide. And we do have a little bit in our bodies. And most things have a little bit, you know, that grow, have a little bit in it. But just a little tiny bit too much and we're dead. But is it what keeps us alive and keeps us cancer free? I don't think so.
Hello, Jack Spearco and all of you prepared people. This is Dr. Ken Berry today answering a question from Tom. Tom says, I would love to hear your thoughts on the trophoblast theory of cancer. All I really know is what I read in G. Edward Griffin's book, A World Without Cancer. In case you're not familiar, the theory goes that cancer is a deficiency disease like scurvy and that tumors are just scar tissue run amok when a certain hormone, vitamin B17, aka cyanide, is not present to act as an off switch for the body's natural healing processes. Hence the reason anything that damages the body at the cellular level can potentially be the cause of cancer. So, Tom, I love G. Edwards Griffin's work on economics and social science. The Creature from Jekyll Island is one of my favorite books of all time, but G. Edward Griffin is displaying what I call an island of ignorance in a sea of knowledge, and all experts are capable of making this error. He's very well versed on economics and sociology and psychology, but he doesn't know a damn thing about human physiology or molecular biology. Cancer is not a deficiency disease like scurvy. Cancer is a metabolic process. I've looked into B17 that you get from bitter almonds. I looked into it thoroughly. There's not a shred of research to support that. He knows a lot about a lot, but he just doesn't know what he's talking about when it comes to this. He may have passed. Maybe I should say he didn't know what he was talking about. But for all you guys listening, read G. Edward Griffin's books about economics and sociology, but don't listen to him and take cancer advice from him, because that is an island of ignorance in his vast sea of knowledge. Hope this helps. This is Dr. Barry. Talk to you guys next time.
You know, this is why I have an expert counsel. Not because I couldn't have, like, found that answer and gave it to you. It's not what I mean. I don't know what the right term for it would be, like inferred expertise or deferred expertise. I guess inferred expertise. People that are really known as being very smart and knowing a lot about certain things can often kind of go off in the periphery, pick another thing and claim they know a thing about it. And the people that follow them will say, well, if he says it, it must be true. That's not the case. I'll only go so far with diet and medical advice because I'm not a doctor or a nutritionist. I'll just tell you what's worked for me and how it works. Good answer from Ken. Let's go on and talk about a toilet won't flush sometimes because you don't have a septic. How's that work? I'm going to tell you what you're about to hear is not that unusual. It's not limited to the place this guy lives.
Hey, everybody. It's Sean Mills with Hack My Homestead, and today I've got another septic question. This is from Charlie. Charlie says, how do you get reliable toilet flushes without an actual septic tank? I live in an old house that was built without a septic system. The wastewater runs out a pipe into the pasture a few feet away. This works sometimes, but I often have trouble getting the toilet to flush when there's been rain. Also, I get a bad sewer smell on those days, and the water in the toilet looks brackish. I don't own this house, but is there something I could do without investing too much in someone else's property to get myself a reliable flush from this old non-system? I've been told this is a common setup in Kentucky. Thanks for everything. It's appreciated. Well, Charlie, I would be very surprised if your house, in fact, does not have a septic system. About the time that they started bringing plumbing into houses, they had regulations for how that wastewater had to be treated, and a pipe running out into a field, I don't believe, was ever part of that plan. I could be wrong, but I'm going to answer your question the way that it's written, but I would definitely, if I were you, look into whether or not you're just sending, you know, all your waste down a pipe into a field, because I got a feeling that's wrong, but that's okay. Let's talk about how a toilet works. So your toilet bowl is full of water, and there is a tube on the back of or on the bottom of your bowl that goes up into the back of your toilet, not the back part that has water, but a back tube that's about the same height as the water level. And so the way this works is if you were to pour, say, a cup of water into your toilet, the water level would rise slightly. And it would rise above the level of this inverted U that's on the back of the toilet. And that water would, you know, just basically drain out. Okay. But when you flush a toilet, you add all the contents of the reservoir tank to the bowl. That causes the water level to rise enough to actually close off that inverted U on the back of the toilet. And this creates a siphon. So the falling water in the tube essentially is at a lower pressure than the water in the bowl. And so that higher pressure water from the bowl pushes its way and pushes your waste with it through the siphon tube and out into wherever that leads to. So if you have a problem getting this toilet to work when it rains, what could be happening is that that pipe that you referenced could be filling up with water partially or fully. And what happens is when that water level rises and starts to want to create the siphon, it traps air in between the water that you just introduced to the pipe and the water that's already in the pipe, which negates that pressure differential between the either side of the siphon. So this could happen from a bunch of different reasons. It could be that there's a buildup in the siphon tube itself, and so the water flow is just not high enough to create that pressure differential. It could be, like I said, that you have existing water in the tank, or you could have – or not in the tank, but in the pipe. You could have roots and other blockages in the pipe that, again, when there's free airflow there, allows the siphon to work. But when there isn't, because it's clogged up with water, then it doesn't work properly. So one of the things that you should probably look at is the toilet itself. If you're renting this house, you might mention the problem to the homeowner and just ask if they could replace the toilet with a higher efficiency. I don't know what they call them, but they've got like these pressure jet type toilets that just kind of shoot the waste out. They're kind of crazy. I've been to a few houses that have them. And they're almost startling the first time you use them because the water rushes out of there so fast. So you might try to get a toilet that could overcome that pressure differential as a low-cost solution. Or you might even put that in and then just swap the toilet back out and take your nice special toilet with you when you move out. But the other thing to do would to be to similar to what I described with the other guy that had the drain field problem, which is manage the land around the drain field to not have excess water and make sure that that pipe is clean. So, you know, whether that be water jetting and root augering or some other solution, if it's literally just a pipe running from your house into a field, the most cost-effective way might be to just dig that up and replace the pipe. I wouldn't tell anyone that that's happening because I would imagine a non-septic system is not one that's going to be grandfathered into the old rules. But if that's what's going on, that would be a solution that works. The pipe is probably perforated. It's supposed to allow water to flow out into the drain field. And so because of those perforations, you can have things like clay and roots and other things move into the pipe and restrict that flow. So managing that outflow pipe could be a thing. If it turns out that your house does have a septic system, it sounds like what could be happening is that the system is full and needs to be pumped. And then what's happening when you have rain is running from the drain field into the septic system because the water level basically stays flat. You don't have that reservoir in there because you've got sludge buildup in the initial septic tank. So you might double check the septic tank thing and see if that's a problem. If it's not, then this is either the toilet not putting enough pressure through or that pressure being stopped by water already in the pipe, which can be managed with cleaning the pipe and managing the amount of water that you're sending down. So hope that helps out. Charlie, good luck with that problem. And you guys keep getting questions into Jack. I'll keep getting them answered.
All right. So I agree with Sean's list of potential remedies. The idea that this isn't common and that there probably is a septic tank, I'm sorry, Sean, you're wrong on this one. The house I grew up in rural Pennsylvania was put onto sewer about 2005 by brute force, as most of the homes in the area were. As the county that I grew up, called Schuylkill County, decided to go out to all these places and make that happen. My father lives in this house now. Somebody bought the land behind him, and this would have had to happen anyway. Once that happened, there was a giant stripping hole back there, which is where they would dig the coal out of the ground and leave this giant scar on the land. And our house was just the other side of one of these holes that was largely refilled, so that this was one that they didn't completely destroy everything with. There wasn't that much coal there. It was done about the 1920s and 30s, this particular strip mining operation, so it was better than most. But I mean, we had like a huge shell bank behind us, and I'd find all kinds of fossils in the shell and that when I was a kid, mostly plant fossils and stuff like that. And we used to shoot we used that hole actually as like a skeet range, and we used it like we cut the trees down in there as they would regrow and leave stumps, and we'd set clays on them and use it as a rifle range and stuff like that. Well, just to the back side of the piece that we pushed out on the bank with a bobcat so that we could do that, there was pipe came out, and it was straight out of the toilet. Now, we never had this back pressure problem, because that's what it is, and I'll explain it with aquaponics here in a second, what causes this when there's rain, what's really going on here. But there were times when someone, right, my grandfather would be like, I'm going to count to 20, go out there and tell me if you see water come out the pipe. Right, and he'd go flush the toilet or turn on the faucet then, and I'd stand there and see either water came out or didn't, and whether it was a clog or not, and did it come out fast or did it trickle out, you know? So I can tell you for a fact that that was, you know, for that time frame, we're talking going back to the 80s, but the time that my dad was compelled beyond his resistance that you have got to do this, and I don't know why he and many others resisted it. It didn't make any sense. They didn't charge you to do it. The county literally did the work. You just had to let them. And they got a point where, like, we're bringing a sewer line through, and you're getting tied in or you're getting thrown out. And everybody caved and let it. Like, it didn't make any sense. But I just think it's just people that just don't trust the state, period. The fact that there's still places like this does not surprise me. Now, what can happen, and this is probably why the rain is what's doing it, once there's water flooded in that field where that pipe is, to the point where when you flush, either the water's already covering the escape hatch, let's say, or the surge that you send through, like let's say there's a little gap there, but your surge causes that gap to rise and basically cover the end of the pipe with water, will break a siphon. It'll do it every time. When we design aquaponics systems and we're returning water to a sump or a lower tank in the system, even if we're not all the way back to the sump, we always want to design them so there's two things going on. There's enough pipe coming out the bottom to create pull on the bell siphon, and that the water level that comes up in the return tank never touches the bottom of the pipe, because if it touches it for even half a second, it'll break the siphon. It'll just immediately break it. So one short-term problem, and you might want to maybe do this after you don't use the John for a while, if you know what I mean, maybe give it a day or three and it's kind of dry out, is wherever that pipe is to go dig some sort of a channel away from it so that when water pools during rain events, it just doesn't pool up there. That would be like the low-tech, no-cost solution to get out of this. Because one of the things you could do, as Sean kind of inferred there, is you could like kind of bring in the man to make the other man that you rent from fix the problem, but that can lead to other problems. I'll just say that. Like, oh, I'm going to fix it, and now your rent's going up $300 a month because I'm going to have to recapture this. So you need to make those kind of calls yourself. But I think that's probably the problem, and I think the way you describe the problem as the pipe going out into a field is probably true, especially in rural Kentucky. I can see this being the case in a lot of places still.
Hey, TSP community. This is Kerry Brown from Strong Roots Resources, where we're building resilience from the ground up. And today I'm going to go into some depth about persimmon trees. So the American persimmon is a pretty common tree in much of the U.S. You'll find it in old pastures, on the edges of wooded areas, and it's even pretty common in public parks and on industrial sites. And here around the farm, we've actually got them coming up all around the pastures here, mainly from seed that I suspect the coyotes and deer have deposited after eating the fruit. But we do have one on, a mature one on a kind of southwestern edge that is probably about 60 feet tall and is prolifically dropping fruit right now. These trees are hardy as far north as zone 5, and they aren't really picky about the soil as long as it's not saturated. They do well in full sun, but they will tolerate shady edges. But in that case, they tend to be just shorter and more shrub-like if they're under that canopy. The bark has this blocky pattern that's pretty distinctive if you're working on your wintertime tree identification. And I always like to reference Sam Thayer's Field Guide to Wild Edible Plants to get more specific ID details on these trees, especially in the dormant season. So we mostly know about the fruit. It's one of the last summer fruits that come ripe. It's kind of a light to medium orange, and the taste is described as rich and creamy and more pulp than juicy. And you do need to be sure that you are grabbing these at their full ripeness. Some people will tell you that you actually don't have ripe fruit until after the first frost, but I've found that that's not always the case. I have found some ripe just a few weeks ago, and they were pretty good. But the microclimate does matter when it comes to the ripening of the fruit, so you just kind of need to study your individual trees. If that fruit is tart or astringent and you feel like you just turned your mouth inside out, it's just too green. It's just not ready. But it is a really good fruit enjoyed fresh. Some people will dry it into fruit leathers. you can bake it where it can kind of act as like a substitute for pumpkin. And it's not unusual that you're actually harvesting most of the fruit off of the ground versus pulling it off the tree. Because their canopy is so tall, it makes a lot of sense to just spread a tarp underneath that tree and harvest it that way. But in addition to the fruit, the persimmon tree actually offers quite a bit more. So the leaves are high in vitamin C, and they can be dried and used in teas, particularly the Asian varieties. The seed can be pressed for an oil. Some folks compare that to peanut oil. And the seeds can also be roasted as a coffee substitute. But I don't think it contains caffeine, so take that as you will. And finally, the inner bark has been used to alleviate sore throats and fevers. In addition, the wood from the persimmon trees have been used in creating golf club handles and billiard cues because it's incredibly strong and dense. It's also very dark and straight, so it works well if you're running it on like a lathe. For pollination, you're going to need both male and female trees in order to set fruit, for the American persimmon, that is. There are some self-fertile varieties, but the more common American persimmon will get about 60 feet tall with about a 40-foot spread of canopy. And if you find multiple young persimmon trees close to one another, they might actually all be suckers coming up off the root system of an older tree. There's multiple cultivars of the American persimmon. The Dooley and the Geneva Red cultivars do better in the cooler climates, and the Meader, that's M-E-A-D-E-R, is self-fertile. So that's a good addition to consider for your food forest. And most persimmons can be propagated by seed, root cuttings, or grafting. It's also a valuable tree that's planted by folks who are managing lands for hunting habitat, since the fruit is browsed by deer, turkey, and bears. If you're looking for a more compact, self-fertile persimmon to add to your food forest, take a look at the Fuyu persimmon. That's an Asian cultivar that's spelled F-U-Y-U. And it sets a larger fruit that's close to the size of an apricot. They're just a little more kind of squat and flat. And I remember I saw a Fuyu on a customer's property that had about 20 pounds of fruit on a tree that wasn't much more than 5 feet tall. And I just planted one last fall to my own food forest, so I'm looking forward to getting a harvest off of that within a couple of years. For citations and further information, take a look at the Plants for a Future website. That's pfaf.org. My buddy Andy Eddings told me about this a few years ago, and it's become an excellent resource for foraging research, for building out food forest systems and things of that nature. It's just wonderful for the avid forager and the plant nerd. And the books that they publish to support the hosting fees are great references for woodland gardening and food forest creation. So if you'd like to talk more or learn more about the wild, medicinal, edible, and otherwise useful species on your land, I do offer in-person property walks, foraging classes, consulting, and education, as well as identification, GPS tagging, and documentation of those species on your property. I have a travel radius of about 4 hours from Knoxville, Tennessee, so if you're in that area, reach out to me, and I'd be happy to talk further and get that scheduled. Y'all have a good week, and I'll talk to you next time.
So add-ons on that, the Fuyu persimmon, I had one here. It produced a few fruits. This is just too brutal of an environment for it. It's turned out that this environment that I have is too brutal for a lot of things. Just the shallow nature of the soil is the issue, not the quality or anything. Just trees don't like to grow in 5 inches of dirt and rock. I mean, they just don't. So, but when it produced, you know, when we treated it like an infant and made sure that it was taken care of every day to get it through the summers, the fruit that came off, it was amazing. And I would say it wasn't just better than a ripe native persimmon or any astringent variety of persimmon, including other oriental varieties. It was incredibly deliciously better, because to get a persimmon really ripe, you have to do what's called bled it. And so unless it's already really mushy when you get it, you'll bring it in, sit it on a countertop. It'll get mushy, and the astringency will go away as the sugars come up in it. This was like the texture of like I want to say almost like an apple, but not quite that crisp and super sweet. They were fantastic. If I were doing like farm to table marketing with chefs and I had a place like I would put an orchard of these things with other mixed fruits in, and I would make that a seasonal thing for my chefs. I handed one of those to a chef we were selling eggs to at the time, and his exact words were, "This is exciting." So that's the Fuyu. One thing I will tell you is you have to be more mindful of pest issues because they're sweet out of the gate and they don't have to bled out. They are more subject to pest pressure. The Native American persimmon for foraging is amazing, but for you guys that are doing pastured livestock and all, one of the beauties of these things is not only are they one of the last fruit to come ripe, they will often hang on a tree long past leaf drop. And then as winds come in the winter, they'll be dropping this high carbohydrate load as late as, like, you know, after Christmas in a lot of the parts of the country. I mean, up into Virginia, it'll do that. And that means you've got this high carbohydrate caloric bomb for your overwintered livestock through your grazing pathways. And because they're a native plant, they do really well. So that's just my little add-on to that. With that, let's go ahead and hear from Joel Riles about one of the most difficult things you'll ever have to do if you own dogs, and that's decide that it is time to say goodbye to a friend. I will tell you that of all the dogs I've owned, the only one that just passed was Charlie. And had I been home, that probably wouldn't have happened, but I wasn't here, so Dorothy could not handle the situation on her own. And so it is uncommon that a dog will just go to sleep and not wake up. And that's the, I mean, I just saw a guy that I know through social media say that, you know, his dog had passed, and, you know, fortunately for him, it had been that way. And he, the dog was in pretty good spirits. They knew it was soon, but he was still getting around. And the dog literally went to sleep next to him that night, and he woke up and the dog had passed. And that just doesn't happen as often as I think we would prefer. The canine is domesticated, but it comes from a wild animal. And the dog did not evolve to live as long as they do in the world of predator and prey. When something like a coyote or a wolf or any form of wild dog like a dingo gets to the point of weakness where we're still like, that dog's got 2-3 years. Nature does not let that animal continue. And I'm not saying we take a lesson from that. It is then we should decide that's when they go. I think when we take that animal in and we care for them, we make it part of our family, we own those last years as being responsible for them. But that's why we get to a point where we have to then actually take over for nature. And so with that in mind, let's listen to Joel.
Hello, everyone. This is Joel with Fortress Canine and Canine Academy coming back at you today with another expert counsel question. And today's question, I believe it was from Matt, and it's the question that no dog owner really wants to ask. And that is, how do I know when it's the right time to go ahead and put my dog down? So in his particular situation, he's got an older dog. It started getting lesions on it. Not lesions. It's starting to get swelling spots on it. And it's affecting its mobility and stuff like that a little bit. But I'll just give you some general thoughts on this. First of all, I want to say this is one man's opinion. So this is my opinion. Don't make your decision completely based on this. But it's something to consider. So what I always ask myself is, am I not going ahead and making the decision to put my dog down because I genuinely feel like the dog is able to live a good life and is still happy enough that it's willing to deal with the pain and it can have a genuinely good life for a couple more years or a couple more months? Or am I not making the decision to put the dog down because I'm being selfish emotionally and I don't want to have to deal with being sad? If it's the second, if you're just doing it because you don't want to feel sad that your dog is no longer with you, then you're probably being unfair to the dog. But if you genuinely believe that the dog is still having enough of a life that it's, you know, if you were in that situation, would you be willing to keep going? Like if I wake up in the morning and my back is sore, I don't want to be put down, right? I'm willing to deal with some discomfort even though I'm having some pain because life is worth living. But if the dog is in such pain, for instance, if it's not eating and drinking, if it's struggling to even get up to go eat and drink, things like that, then those are pretty good signs that, yeah, it's probably time to just go ahead and make that decision. Now, all that being said, I do want to point out a few things that we've discovered over the years that have really helped rejuvenate dogs, even if it's only for a couple of months. If they are getting, I can't think of the name that the guy used, it's swellings all over its body, right? It's getting tumors. That's what they are. I had a brain fart there. So if the dog's getting tumors, if they're cancerous, what will generally happen is you'll see the tumors, but they'll seem to still be doing okay, and then they'll just crash, right? But if whatever it is, I've had dogs that act like they can barely get up and walk. And it's like, okay, before I make that final decision, I want to just make sure that there's not a few things I can do that will substantially help the dog. One thing we've discovered is adding kefir into their food. If you don't know what that is, K-E-F-I-R, kefir. You can buy it in the store. You can make it yourself. But I have found that for mobility issues and things with the dog's joints, kefir can make a huge difference. I had a dog that was about 7. We thought we were going to have to put her down. She was having mobility issues. We started adding kefir into her food. She lived a good, strong life until she was 12 years old. And when she did finally go, it was quick, right? And so you can add kefir into their food. Joint supplements can really help if it's a joint issue. They're not very expensive. And if the dog is in a situation where they have tumors and there's a good possibility that they are going to crash, but until they get to that point, if I can give them a relatively pain-free life that they can still be happy with, you may be able to get your vet to prescribe Remedil. I don't know exactly how to spell it. I think it's R-E-M-I-D-Y-L, something like that. And it's basically like a really strong form of ibuprofen, but for dogs. And so it's an anti-inflammatory and it's a painkiller. We've used it after surgeries and things like that on dogs. Or if we just have a dog that's having an issue, like maybe they sprained a leg and they're limping a little bit, hey, for a couple days, give them Remedil, get that swelling and inflammation down, and they heal pretty quick, and then they'll be up and running again. So I wouldn't want to do that over a long haul if the dog is, say, in their 6-7-year-old range, and, oh, I'm going to do this for years. But if you're like, I don't want to do it yet because they still seem to have life in them, but there's a really high probability they're going to be going down in the next 6 months, but I'd like them to be pain-free or at least significantly reduce the pain, Remedil can be a good option. It is just like a medication you have to have a prescription from a vet for. So those are things I would try before I make the final decision just to see if it improves the dog's life. But if you're doing it for selfish reasons, it's probably time to put the dog down. If you're doing it because you genuinely feel like the dog still has some life in it, then I would definitely keep that dog around. Enjoy the life you can with your dog. Give him a good life, and then when the time comes, you'll know what to do. All right, guys. I know that's kind of a dark topic today, but I hope it was helpful to some people. Remember, if you want more information on training your dogs, you can check out caninacademy.us. Go to Jack's website, thesurvivalpodcast.com, and click on the banner there so he gets credit for that. And if you're interested in purchasing a working line, a German Shepherd, Belgian Malinois, or Dutch Shepherd, either a puppy or trained, you can check out fortresscanine.com. You can send a consultation request to us, and we will get back to you quickly. Until next time, remember to train hard and stay safe.
Okay, one that was a real new one for me there, but the minute I heard it, I'm like, well, that makes perfect sense, is the kefir. It's basically gut health that you're improving there. It's probiotics. And if you think about what I mentioned, like why we even have to do this, is because dogs are all rooted as wild animals. Dogs in that environment, what do they eat? They eat carrion. They're scavengers and they're predators. And when they eat something that they kill, what do they eat? They eat the guts. And what is their main prey? I know you National Geographic shows you specials of the wolves running down elk or some shit. Mostly what they eat are very small animals, rodents and things, you know, rabbits and rats and mice and voles. I watched one of our hunting dogs. She was a beagle named Queenie. One day she ate about 18 field mice, and I would say she ate those in about 30 minutes. It was back when I was, you know, he's talking about my grandpa talking to me and stuff and drinking his Yingling on the back porch and sitting there listening to AM radio. It was one of those, you know, situations. And we were sitting there in a thing that he called a glider. It was like a outdoor couch that slid back and forth instead of rocked. And I don't know the proper name for him. I just know my grandparents called it a glider. And we sat there, and he's talking, you know, what, she's eating another one. She's eating another one. You could barely see them because they're a little white-foot deer mouse. But every time she got one, she'd turn her head up and eat it like a snake, swallow it right down. And so when they're eating that, they're eating bones and cartilage and all, but they're also eating all the insides of an animal that's living on roughage. And their digestive system is got a quite a bit of a fermentational process in it. And they're eating all of it, everything from the poop that's about to come out up to the food that just went in, and then the whole body. And so a dog's digestive system in nature has got to be massively aggressive with biologics in it. And when we're feeding them kibble, I think that, you know, they're going to lose a lot of that, right? I mean, they might be better off eating more of the roadkill off the road than we let them eat, is what I'm saying. So that makes a lot of sense. There's two other things that I'll add to what Joel said, which was a fantastic segment. I'm so glad we have him. Back in the 80s, we had a Brittany Spaniel named Britt because, yeah, I was such a creative kid when it came to naming a dog that I named a Brittany Spaniel Britt. I did name him Bushwhacker Britt. Okay, right? That was his official name on his papers. But he got older, and he couldn't hunt anymore. And I'm going to tell you, all hunting dogs love to hunt, but this dog, he lived for it. When we went, like, in the summer when we were going fishing out to the river, a dog just knows you loaded a bunch of shit into the Jeep and left early in the morning, and to him, you're going hunting. Same thing with deer. You can't go because we're hunting deer. I'm a dog. I go, right? When we would do this and he didn't get to go, we would literally sneak out of the house. That's how much this dog loved this. And he got to a point where when we would take him out, he just couldn't do it. He would go to get into the bush, and as soon as he hit a few things, he'd kind of stumble. And I talked to my uncle. I had just read an article in Outdoor Life. It was either Outdoor Life or Sports Afield, because those were the two we always got. And it was about giving dogs vitamin C, hunting dogs in their later years vitamin C, and giving them like a mega dose of vitamin C only when you took them out and worked them. And we did it, and he got two more years. And that dog, it was like somebody flipped a switch when we did that. I'm not saying it can be done continuously. I don't know, but I'm telling you it worked. The other thing is, and I had to look it up because I couldn't remember the name of the drug, but vets now have access to a drug that's being marketed for psoriatic arthritis called Embryl. It's a biologic. And for the last couple months for Charlie, we had him on it, and it made him his old self. And it's mainly for the aches and, again, psoriatic arthritis and everything that goes along with that, which can include things like, you know, psoriasis, but it's really about the inflamed joints. And my vet explained to me that it does things for dogs that he can't even explain on what the drug is supposed to do, including making them more their old self. He has an aging blue heeler, and she was always the boss dog. And she's not anywhere near the end, is what he told me, but she had just gotten to where, like, she wasn't the boss dog anymore. Like, she was deferring to all the other dogs and everything and just not happy. And they put her on this, and he said it turned her around. And I have to say, I saw that in our guy, too, for a while. So that might be something else that you can look at if you're in that situation. Talk to your vet about it. He did, so, you know, you had to have it done monthly. And they won't give it to you and let you do it yourself because people are now using it as kind of an anti-aging protocol. And it actually seems like there might be a future for it in that, but we don't know if it's safe yet or not. But there's also an extreme risk for pregnant women to use it. So they're being really tight on it, given that certain segments of the population are seeing it as a fountain of youth type of thing. But for an old dog, I don't think you can really do anything that bad as far as long-term consequences of something like that. So that did work for him, and it gave him a couple more good months. All right, let's go ahead and take another one. This is a very brief one from Jeff the Berkey Guy Gleason on what's been going on with Berkey and the frickin' EPA.
Hey, this is Jeff the Berkey Guy. You can reach me at directive21.com. or usaberkeyfilters.com, our newer Berkey site. I've been, obviously, many of you know, I've been advertising with Jack since 2008 when he had 300 episodes, give or take. So we have a good 15, 16-year history with Jack. And recently he asked me to kind of explain the EPA situation. And it goes back to about 2022 where the EPA put Berkey on the radar through its claims of bacteria and virus removal, and then silver in the black Berkey elements. And so they wanted to then, well, they had said, well, we don't want to classify it as a pesticide like Roundup or something like glyphosate because of its silver in it. And then all of a sudden they changed face, and in end of 2022 and then into 2023, they put a stop order against Berkey International, which is the importation assembly arm in Puerto Rico that assembles the black Berkey element and the systems with the black Berkey elements. So they did a stop order against them, but they didn't do a stop order against New Millennium Concepts. And that in itself, nobody knows why, but they only put it on their importation arm. And they still to this day have not gone after or put a stop order on New Millennium Concepts. I don't know why. That's in Texas. So we still get product to this day. We still get systems. And so we sell them, and we've done that indefinitely. As reading, even when Berkey ended up suing the EPA after May of 2023, they sued them in 2024. But long story short is that the EPA would not back down from and not let them continue on without getting past the stop order. And so obviously some dealers have now gone away. We're just trying to, you know, get through this. But in some of the filings of the documents, the EPA said that New Millennium Concepts does not have a stop order. They can manufacture and they can sell the black Berkey elements. Anyone who doesn't have a stop order is not breaking the law, in other words. So that was a breath of fresh air for us that still have the product and still selling it. So we are still selling systems right now. We don't know the outcome. Berkey is still in court in Puerto Rico. You can look at Pacer, and it is a cost per service, but you can look up all the filings and all the arguments. And Berkey's arguments, and I agree with them, are it was done, you know, arbitrarily, capriciously. It was done unfairly. Berkey is the only company targeted in any of these stop orders in the gravity water filtration market. Not one other company. There are multiple companies that have silver and claim bacteria and virus removal. They were in the court documents. The evidence was there. And so far, nothing has come of it. The EPA arguments, they're making their arguments, and I don't agree with them. We'll see what happens. There's no finality to it in this 5-minute recording. There's not much I can say about Berkey right now. We haven't lost, but haven't won the case yet. And so then you get into the availability of filters and stuff like that. Right now, it's very difficult to get black Berkey elements. We're hoping for some type of judicial, relief somewhere. I know Berkey is. And that time will tell. Right now, I don't have any updates on that. I wish I did. But right now, I don't have any updates. So I can't say anything about that. All I know is that most people I talk to in this industry know that the Berkey was unfairly targeted. And the judge should give some precedence to that, because they haven't gone after anyone else. And their argument at the EPA is, we can do whatever the hell we want, and you and your opinion doesn't matter. Like, we can do whatever we want. And that's really disgusting. So it's definitely an overreach by the government. I know a lot of people with Jack are disgusted by government actions, and so is Jack. So I hope to give another update soon. I just know that we're here. We're moving forward. We're selling everything we can get, everything we can sell, everything we can, accessories at usaberkeyfilters.com. And, I mean, millions of people use Berkey water filters and have in the world, not just in America. It's a loved brand, and it's sad to see the government, you know, ask pretty much the Berkey company to comply or die. That's kind of how we look at it. So I hope this has been informative. If you have any follow-up questions, maybe Jack and I can do an interview together, or just ask Jack, or you can write, you know, questions to us at usaberkeyfilters.com. All the best. Take care. Bye-bye.
So what this makes me think of, I read a book, I think it was by Andrew Weil, and I think it was written in the 80s, and I read it somewhere in the 90s, and it was about how this type of thing happens with the EPA even back then. And it was some company in California that was making this bread. They were baking this bread, and they were using the same ingredients as other bakeries but they made some sort of a health claim about it. And it was a completely valid thing. It was like something in the, like, it wasn't this, but let's just say they had fortified the bread with vitamin C and said, if you eat this bread, you won't get scurvy, which would be completely true. It was something, I don't remember the specific, but it was something that obvious. The EPA came in and said the bread was now a drug, and they didn't just shut the company down. They literally destroyed all the bread and threw it away. And they said, can we give it to the homeless? No, it's a drug. This is how stupid this is. And so what Jeff was getting at, I don't know if it was completely clear there, you can buy these elements that are manufactured under a different name. They're exactly the same physically. They're the same product. They'll go right in your Berkey, but they're not marketed under the Berkey name. And that's totally okay. And the reason is, Berkey simply made a claim that is valid. It kills viruses. And the way it kills viruses is there's silver in the elements, and when a virus passes over silver, it'll kill it. Or certain bacteria, it'll kill it. Well, it became a pesticide when they said what it does, not when it was put in there. You understand that? And this is ridiculous, and we'll have to see where it goes. And I can only believe the Chevron deference decision strengthens Berkey's case, but the problem is this is already in motion, and the federal government has unlimited time and money because they steal your money, and when they don't have enough of your money they stole, they print more. And they can destroy people and companies using lawfare because somebody somewhere got a hair up their ass and decided they wanted to do it, and that's what this is. So we'll have to wait to see how it plays out, but you can get black Berkey elements. They're just not going to be called black Berkey elements. They're going to be black they're going to be black elements for your Berkey. And like I said, I think it'd be a good idea if you want to make sure that you know when he has product in stock to get on his email list, and we'll see where this goes. Just know this is actually a good dovetail into what I want to talk about today. And as I said, I think there's a major awakening happening. But I also wonder, what will that do to the unraveling? Will it make it more violent, make it more rapid? Like, if the unraveling takes longer, do people's emotions have more time to kind of adjust? And if it happens much more rapidly, is the potential for violence worse? Is the snapback from the dying beast of the current? See, I don't think the state will drop and go away at the end of this, but the current version of it is going to have to evolve and change and reboot. Because it's the Matrix, and Neo means new, by the way, okay? And we're at the end where the architect falls apart, and it all has to start all over again. But the architect's like, we've done this before, okay? That's where we are in society. That's what an unraveling is. That's what the movie was really about. That's why the character's name is Neo. People throw around words like neocon and neolib all the time, and they don't know what they're saying. It means new. New liberal, new conservative, and they're one and the same. It's 2 feet of the same being, neo-living. Just neos is what they are, the new version of the old scum, rebooting. And that reboot happened in post-war America, after World War II, in the last crisis, and then rebuilding. And the American hive lasted till about the mid-60s. And then we had the interim unraveling around the Vietnam War. Then we had the Reagan's mourning in America, right? A little fake high in the middle, and then a relative period of peace in the 90s until we got into a long duration, 20 years of war. And now we're at a point where all of this has come to a head, and right in the middle of all that time, in 1971, I know that I sound like a broken record with this, but when we left the gold standard, it's not just that it was a bad decision economically, it empowered the government to do things that the government never would have been able to do had it not been done. You couldn't have, if we were still on that standard, you couldn't have $34 trillion worth of debt. Not just because it controls inflation, it controls spending. It doesn't let the government continuously borrow and borrow and borrow and never worry about, like, let me explain something to you that I think is hard for the average person to understand. The number $34, $35 trillion of debt does not distress anyone in your government right now who is a believer in government. About the only people that would distress are people that are renegades, Rand Paul, Thomas Massie, All right? That's the only people concerned about it. Everybody else knows what's going on, and they don't care because there is no plan to pay it back. They don't care that it'll be $150 trillion someday. Eh, doesn't matter. It doesn't matter. This is the system. It works this way. The more debt you have, the more money you have, because money is debt and debt is money. So they're not worried about it at all. But what it did is it caused an acceleration in stupidity. It caused an acceleration of bad policy. It caused an acceleration of global wars that we called regional wars. Because if you have a country in North America prosecuting a war in Southwest Asia, is that not a global fucking war? How much more global do you need to be? And you have proxies from all sides engaged in it just because they're not directly... You see what I'm saying here? We had 20 years of global conflict, two theaters, one in Afghanistan, one in Iraq, and 20 other odd little places were fucking shit up and blowing shit up. And then the pandemic came. And it's odd to me, it's kind of an ironic thing, what year did it... I mean, 2019 is what we say, but when did it really happen? 2020. What does 2020 mean to you? I know it's a TV show. Why was it a TV show? When you hear somebody has 2020, you think what? Vision. Clear sight. I think it's ironic that in 2020, we got a clear vision into what was really going on. Many people like me had given up 90% of hope on everything. Medicine, authority, the state, right? 90% was gone. We had this little 10% vestige. That, well, you know, doctors at least will give the drug they know will fix the problem. No, they won't. No, they won't. They'll let a person die in their ER because they're fucking dehydrated because fluids is not on the protocol for COVID-19. I'm fucking done. I don't even have to get to HCQ and ivermectin from there. I had an EMT or paramedic email me when my wife went through it, and we just got a private hydration company to come to the house and do it, and in 15 minutes she was better because she was dehydrated, because that was one of the things that can happen when you get the... And that's a very simple thing to fix. I wonder how many of the oh my God, they all died. How many of them died because a fucking doctor wouldn't give them goddamn fluids? Okay? How many? I don't know, but it ain't zero. How many had serious complications that if it had been treated early on, I'll let it go. My point is, we saw everything. Anybody that still believes now chose not to look at it and not to accept it because their tribe didn't benefit by seeing it. That's it. If you have any faith in the establishment right now, let me just be honest, your IQ is in the 80s. Either because you were born that way or because you've chosen to dumb yourself down to that level. Well, every day since then, more and more people have gone, I don't think I want to do this anymore. And when I woke up and I saw the vibe, the network effect output on X today, it did two things to me. One, it gave me hope, and I immediately checked my hope. I've had hope so many times in my people. And I don't mean you. I mean, when I say my people, I mean all the people. To collectively, in mass, wake up to what's going on. And I've always been disappointed. And I think you can only, you know, it's like the little kid that thinks his daddy's really coming back for Christmas this year. There's a point where the kid stops looking out the window, right? It's a little past supper time. All right, does anybody know where that's from? I guess you got to be an 80s kid to know. Something about a faster pussycat, right? A little past supper time, right? Like, it stops sitting out there waiting anymore. Well, that's how I feel about waiting for this country to wake up. Then I immediately had another thought. Well, what if you're wrong? Now that it's gone this long, this far, with this much tension built up, this much potential energetic release, what if it goes kinetic? And I'm back to, people are making a very dumb choice in their minds when they use the term civil war. And the first thing they think about is like the 80s miniseries, The Blue and the Gray. When they think about the South versus the North, there has very seldom in the history of the world been wars that look like that. And even less seldom have there been wars in the history of the world that were considered civil wars when they happened that way. A civil war is a battle for control of territory this is not a judgment on the morality of either side when I say this. This is a tactical examination of military history when I say this. The United States Civil War was a failed war for independence. The South fought a war for independence from the North. It was not a civil war. You want to know what a civil war looks like? Look up what went on in Bosnia-Herzegovina. That's a civil war. Neighbor killing neighbor. Not just brother killing brother that live 1,000 miles away. Neighbor killing neighbor. Civil wars are the bloodiest, most destructive wars on society that there are. And there is no clear line right now. There is no, well, it'll all be over there. And I know it's easy to look at the left and the commies and say, well, look how weak they are. They're all the people with no guns. It doesn't mean they don't have a tremendous capacity for violence, and it doesn't mean that the government does not have the ability to maintain control of its enforcers, at least to a large degree. Even if, say, half of them walk away, that's a lot of guys with unlimited supplies. I will tell you that even in the American Civil War, which was much cleaner than this would be this time, both sides thought 2 weeks, a month tops, this will be all over. It was almost 5 years. And up until that point, the bloodiest thing that ever happened to a modern country at the time. It would be a joke compared to today. It would be a joke compared to today. It would not be two sides lighting up on a battlefield. And when I think about this in the future for my grandchildren, it scares the hell out of me. But I also understand something about the movement of history. We don't get to choose it. We don't get to choose to deal with the wave or not. We either ride it or we get destroyed by it. That's the choice we get to make, is how we react to it. And I really think that we have a potential for this to go two ways. A mass awakening and enough people outside of the state waking up collectively to become ungovernable and then to rebuild the system. And it will probably be a terrible result eventually, but it'll probably be good for a while. That's how the turnings work. Yeah? Or complete breakdown. I don't see a lot in the middle. I don't see a lot in the middle. If there's a middle ground, it would be something like Texas and maybe some adjoining states, maybe Florida and some adjoining states. Regional dissolution of the Union, actually looking more like the 1860s, where states say, I don't want to do this anymore. And that's actually the place that I think you'd have a potential middle ground. That's where everybody says, well, that would be where we'd have full all-out war or something, shit like that. No. There is not the political will for that today. Now, there could be, but right now there isn't. Right now there isn't. And and there's also no guarantee that it would work out. Everybody says to me, well, if Texas secedes, I'm moving there. First, I'm going to tell you, if you want to do that, you better move before it happens. Because when a state becomes a nation, it's not like just anybody who wants to can come here, especially when immigration is a major concern and problem to begin with. Right? Everybody wants the revolution until it's time to do revolution shit, right? So there's that, but there's no guarantee that a Texas secession wouldn't result relatively quickly, a decade or so, in a totalitarian state that makes look like what we're dealing with nothing. Remember when the colonies revolted against King George, it was over like a 2% tax on tea and shit like that. The average person kept 95% of their income. The average person kept 95% of their income, and it was a bridge too far. What do you keep today? What do you keep today? What do we do about it? Stay aware. Be prepared. Build community. Know that you might have to depend on others more than you can imagine right now. But keep waking up minds. The dangerous part is where the number of people awake is sufficient to be the catalyst to the turning, but it's not sufficient to be so overwhelming that the turning has to accept it. What you want is enough collective awakening that there's so much of it that the beast has to basically downsize itself and accept it and rebuild. And I don't think the odds of that are very high. Like I'm saying, my wife is taking most of her information in from her own observations, not from my opinions. I know that's hard for people to understand, but think of your own relationship with your own wife if you have one, or your husband if you have one. They take their information in for themselves. They're independent beings of you. They say two become one in a way, but you're also still two. She's coming to the same conclusions from totally different feedback mechanisms and loops. Maybe we don't need to be where we are. Maybe we need to be a little further away from all this shit. That is the biggest bellwether I can experience. I don't care what you show me of assassination attempts. I don't care what you show me of pedophile rings. I don't care what you show me of deceptive nature of government. I don't care. I've seen it all. I've seen more than I talk about. That only means so much to me. When I see a person like my wife, who's one of the most pacifist people I know, who's one of the most concerned people I know about other people, who's one of the most compassionate people I've ever met in my life. I mean, there's a reason I'm in love with this woman and married her so many years ago. There's a reason I chose to raise a son with her, and I'm blessed to be raising grandchildren with her partially right now. I mean, their parents take care of them too. Don't take it that way, but we're part of that process. And when she comes to that conclusion, I pay attention, and when I pay attention to something, if you've listened to the show for a while, you know you should probably pay attention to it too. So I don't have a good upswing on this. Just be prepared and pay attention is all I got for you right now. We'll talk more about some solutions next week. Tomorrow we'll have a Friday flashback. I'd like to thank you for tuning in today. I will tell you real quick here at the end, you can always help the show supporting us by do your online shopping at tspaz.com. Well, that Frigidaire portable ice maker that was on sale last week for $87, somebody was mad at me this week in the comments because it wasn't on sale anymore. It was on sale like Monday, and then they were like Tuesday trying to buy it, and it's like, it's $129. Yes, it is. The sale went away. Turns out this morning I got a price alert on it. It's back down to $87. I don't know how long. If you want to add that to your preps, a great way to make a lot of ice with a little bit of energy, huge value is a prepper item. You might want to pick up one today, and with that's all I'll say about that. Also, real quick, yeah, the cover crop course. It's going to become more and more important to be able to grow your own food and to produce your own food and to know how to do it and to know how to do it without all their bullshit, all their chemicals, all the products you, even the ones that aren't bad, all the ones you go to the store to buy, all the stuff at the feed store or the Home Depot or the nursery. Be able to do it the way nature does it. That's what that course will do for you. You can learn more at homefoodsystems.com. Again, tomorrow, Friday flashback, and then next week we'll do it all over again.
Are they going to bail you out or just run you around? They said you should have a house the American way. A dollar down, a dollar a month, and you never have to pay. There's a better way. Let me show you a better way.